In 1981, Stevie Nicks released the album Belladonna, featuring the iconic song Edge of 17. The song's title came from a conversation that Stevie Nicks had with Tom Petty's wife, Jane. She had asked Jane about first meeting Tom, and she responded they met at the age of 17. But based upon Jane's thick Florida accent, Stevie thought she had said the edge of 17. The song started by being about what Stevie imagined Jane and Tom were like when they were 17 years old. But after both John Lennon and Stevie's own Uncle John had died, it became a song about sadness and helplessness in the wake of the loss of a loved one. In many ways, Edge of 17 could be the theme song for the Amanda Lewis case. Superficially, there's the thick Florida accent you've heard throughout this season. And then, there's the sadness and helplessness that Amanda's had based upon losing three children, two to death, and AJ to what you'll hear about this episode. And then, there's the 17 of it all. It's been 17 years since Amanda's murder trial. 17 years served on a sentence of life without the possibility of parole. 17 years of wrongful conviction. But beyond that, there's the original basis for the song. Stevie Nicks trying to imagine what Tom Petty and his wife were like all the way back at the age of 17. As you listen to this episode, imagine that you were 17 years old, living in the panhandle of Florida, shopping at the local supermarket, when you overheard two police officers talking about a case, a mother who had drowned her daughter in the family pool. Then, imagine you were called for jury duty in that case and asked about what you knew about it. And then you were selected, not as a presiding juror, but as an alternate. You sat through 4 days of trial thinking you'd be dismissed at the close of the case. But then, at the very end of trial, without any explanation, you were told that you were now a presiding juror, one of six who would decide whether the mother had drowned her daughter or tried to save her. What would be your state of mind? And what would you think when all this was brought back to your attention 17 years later?
Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed, the State versus Amanda Lewis. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleague, Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. This is the 11th and final regular episode in our deep dive series in the Amanda Lewis case. Back in 2008, Amanda was convicted of the murder of her 7-year-old daughter, Adriana, and given a sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. She's been behind bars ever since.
Last episode, we took you through the timeline leading up to Amanda's trial. After Amanda's son, AJ, told the police that his mom drowned his sister, they asked Amanda to take a polygraph test. Amanda passed it, answering that she did not drown her daughter, and the examiner concluding that her responses did not show deception. And so, while polygraph results are inadmissible in court and weren't enough to drop the case, Amanda was offered a plea deal. If she pleaded guilty to involuntary manslaughter, meaning the accidental drowning of her daughter, she'd be sentenced to 10 years in prison and be a free woman today. As we noted last episode, Amanda turned down the deal.
Other part is you're offered a plea deal of 10 years in exchange for your guilty plea. And what's your reaction to being presented with that plea deal?
Absolutely not. I refused it all the way down, even the second attempt, because he tried twice to get me to do it. And I told him no, because I'm not going to admit to something I didn't do.
And then, as we also noted, Amanda was asked to pick between two perilous options. First, proceed with a jury of 12 and the possibility of the death penalty. Or second, have her jury cut in half, but face a sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole, not a possible execution. Amanda chose this latter option.
Turning to the jury, you were presented with an option before trial. You could have the death penalty on the table with a jury of 12, or the state would decide not to pursue the death penalty, and you would have a 6-person jury. Do you remember having to make that decision and what was going through your head?
Yes, I remember making it. Now that I know what I know and I look back, it's like they knew, one, I'm naive. I've never been in trouble. I don't know anything about the law. I don't know anything about how the court system works, what I can and cannot do, the decisions I can and cannot make for myself. So I have a public defender and I have a state's attorney that are both telling me I need to do it. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, I feel like this is my safest thing because I'm petrified of the death penalty.
Right.
And so on the eve of Amanda's trial, the judge and lawyers set about trying to assemble a jury of six, as well as three alternatives who could step in if jurors had to drop out mid-trial. As we noted in episode one, Adriana died in Estill, Florida, a tiny town in the panhandle of Florida. Indeed, it has a population of under 400 people, and there aren't many more people in the neighboring towns. And so, as you might imagine, there were problems finding jurors who were unaware of the case. For example, here was what one prospective juror said during jury selection.
Ms. Kersey, where did you get your information then?
I have two sons in law enforcement.
Okay, who are they?
Matt Kersey and Tracy Kirk.
Okay, and they're in law enforcement where?
One's in Graceville and one in San.
Okay, and they've talked with you about this case?
Yes.
Were either one of them involved in this case?
No.
So they told you things that they had heard?
Right.
Okay. All right. Without telling me what opinion you may have formed, have you formed an opinion as to the guilt or innocence of the defendant based on what you've heard?
Partially.
Okay. And would you be able to set that aside if you're chosen as a juror and base your decision on only what you hear in the courtroom?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
This is the sort of scary thing you see in small towns with infamous crimes. A prospective juror who has heard about the case from her law enforcement sons and says that she's already formed a partial opinion about Amanda's guilt. And yet, she also says she can set aside those preconceived notions and decide the case based on evidence presented at trial. Now, this juror was not selected to serve on Amanda's jury, but she also was not stricken for cause, which means she could have ended up deciding Amanda's fate. That's also true of jurors who heard about the case from other sources. Many of the prospective jurors said that they had heard about the case at church, including one who had heard about it the day before jury selection.
Mr. Swilly, where did you get your information?
I'm just sure about last night at church.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all in. Yeah, there was a trial coming up. I told him I was going to be on jury day before, and you might give him this one.
Okay.
Hey, you say something about some this? A lot works for children and family, but we do not discuss in what good number she works.
Okay, which office does she work in? Okay, and what does she do with it?
She's not really involved. She's the administrative secretary.
Okay. From what you've heard at church last night, have you formed an opinion as to the guilt or the innocence of the defense?
Yes,
okay. All right. Thank you, sir.
So, yeah, that's Eugene Swilly saying he was at church the day before, was telling people that he had been called for jury duty and was talking to people in his church about the case. And guess what? Eugene Swilly ended up being selected as one of the six jurors for Amanda's trial. Now, beyond many jurors having talked about Amanda's case with friends and family, there were also a ton of jurors who had read or seen news stories about Amanda's case. Here's just one example.
All right, Mr. Locke, where did you get your information, sir?
Just what I read in the paper.
Okay. Do you recall which paper that was?
Battle City.
And do you recall when you read that particular? I don't necessarily have to have a specific date, but has it been recently or it's been some time back?
Way back in the past.
Okay. Do you subscribe to the Panama City paper?
No.
You just happened to see that paper that day.
See that paper.
Okay. Now, from what you read in that newspaper, did you form an opinion as to the guilt or the innocence of the defendant?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you, sir.
That's James Locke saying that he had read an article about Amanda's case in the newspaper. And as with Eugene Swilly, yes, he was also selected as one of the six jurors to decide Amanda's case. There's a particular problem with that, and it's this. We and others have been able to go back in time and review print and TV news coverage of Amanda's case. Notably, law enforcement was pretty tight-lipped about the case, at least to the local media. Indeed, as far as we can tell, they only made one statement to the press, but it contained a pretty serious error. And it was an error that was repeated on TV news and at least a dozen different publications in the area.
Sheriff Lee said that on August 8th, deputies and EMS were called to 3343 First Avenue South in Esto with a report of a child drowning. Officers and EMTs found the victim, Adriana Elaine Hadao, in a pool. Sheriff Lee said that an investigation of the pool, the surrounding area, injuries to the victim, and preliminary autopsy report by Dr. Charles Siebert confirmed eyewitness testimony that Lewis had drowned her daughter. In addition, the report stated that the mother also apparently sent her 5-year-old to find Adriana floating in the pool.
That's Sheriff Dennis Lee, quoted in this TV news piece, and this same story was included in local newspapers around the area. For example, the AP story printed in many papers noted that, quote, officers found Adriana Elaine Hutto in an above-ground swimming pool.
And so, you see the problem. The stories make it look like AJ told Amanda that Adriana was floating in the pool, Amanda then did nothing to get her out, and it was law enforcement officers who had to pull her out of the pool. This made it look like Amanda just left Adriana floating in the pool, which would make her look guilty as hell.
For the last 5 years or so, I have been in that stage of my life where I've got kids of different ages, but I'm also taking care of elderly parents. And there are so many different needs for so many different people to take care of every single generation that I just never had time to take care of my own. It had become impossible to stay on top of my own business, including my own finances. And that's when I discovered Rocket Money. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending and it helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Rocket Money is an incredibly easy app to use. It shows you all your expenses in one place, including subscriptions you forgot about, and you will be surprised at how many subscriptions you forget about. I mean, think about, what did you eat 3 days ago for lunch? You don't remember. I promise you, you do not remember the subscriptions that you took on, not just once. I had services that I had signed up for twice using two different email accounts. I couldn't believe it. But in the app, all you do is it's going to show you all your subscriptions. It's going to show you the next time they're going to renew. You click on it and it says, okay, cancel the subscription, and Rocket Money will do it for you. Their dashboard lays out your total financial picture, including the due dates for your bills, the paydays, and it's such an easy to digest medium. I am not good with finances. My brain just doesn't work like that, but Rocket Money makes it easy to manage and easy to digest and makes it quick. I don't have to spend days and days and days managing this stuff. And if you've got a goal that you want to save for, Rocket Money can analyze your accounts. It'll find like the best time even each month to put a little bit of money aside. They will even try to negotiate lower bills for you because the app will automatically scan your bills to find opportunities to save. And then it gets to work to get you better deals. They will even call customer service and talk to them so you don't have to. So you can get alerts if your bills increase in price, if there's unusual activity in your accounts, if you're close to going over budget, and even when you're doing a good job. But believe me, I know a lot of us struggle to stay on top of this stuff. I was one of those people until I started using Rocket Money. Rocket Money has saved users over $2.5 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars, including over $880 million in canceled subscriptions alone. Their 10 million members save up to $740 a year when they use all of the app's premium features. So cancel your unwanted subscriptions and reach your financial goals faster with Rocket Money. Go to rocketmoney.com/justice today. That's rocketmoney.com/justice. rocketmoney.com/justice.
Here, as you heard, jurors like James Locke had read and heard the news coverage of the case. And so, is it possible they came into the case with a preconceived notion of what had happened that wasn't shaken even after hearing the evidence at trial? Well, with juror James Locke, we don't have to totally speculate. He spoke with True Crime with Aphrodite Jones about why he voted to find Amanda guilty of murder.
I listened, and I listened very good to it, and I believed the boy. I really did.
How so?
The prosecutor asked him, what was that? And he said, that's my mother drowning my sister. I don't see how anybody could make that up with a five-year-old child. I don't.
What about this whole business with the handprint right there on the little girl's face? Do you remember that?
Yes.
What did you make of that?
I really believe it's probably a hand from holding the little girl down. I really believe that.
Did you consider her version of the story that Adriana fell into the pool because she was standing on the red wagon?
No, I never believed that.
What was it?
For the simple fact, she never said, I tried to tear the pool down. I tried to get in the pool. To me, anybody's child that drowns in the pool, and you stand on the side and you don't tear that pool down and you don't get in there with that baby, there's something wrong with you. I'll never believe she tried to save the baby.
Now recall, here's what Amanda's boyfriend Alan said he heard when Amanda called him on the phone around the time of Adriana drowning.
When she called me, I was at work, okay? I was on the phone with her. Her little boy come inside and she told AJ that they needed to get ready. They was going shopping to go tell him to come back in so he could take a shower. Mm-hmm. So next thing I know, I heard my front door open on my trailer. You can know when the door opened. And I heard Amanda go out and down the steps. She had the phone with her. And as soon as she ran into the trailer, heading towards the pool, you could tell that she started in a trot. You could tell my phone was bouncing. And when she got to the pool, it was in the pool upside down. I said, well, get her out, put her on the ground, turn her to her side, and call 911. Mm-hmm. And the next thing I know, the phone goes dead. So I waited probably 5 or 6 minutes, called her back. She said she'd call 911, and they had paged out in the fire department.
That's consistent with Amanda's claim that she ran out to the pool when AJ told her that Adriana was in it. And then again, here's what Amanda told the police and later the jury about getting Adriana out of the pool.
Were you standing in the wagon?
No, I was standing on the ground. And the side that I was on, the pool's not even. So it was kind of leaning that way, and I just leaned over.
This makes you wonder about what James Locke said in his TV interview. Sure, you could construe what he said as consistent with Amanda's statement. While Amanda said she was able to pull Adriana out of the pool from the ground, maybe James Locke thought a loving mother would have tried to tear down the pool and get in to save her daughter. Of course, trying to do that with a family's inflatable pool would have been disastrous for reasons we've noted before. Well, what Amanda did allowed her to immediately start CPR and call 911. Nonetheless, it's at least possible to interpret what James Locke said as understanding what Amanda said she did and finding it fell short. But the other interpretation is that James Locke was stuck on his priors, that he'd read in the newspaper that it was the police officers who had pulled Adriana from the pool, and that therefore he couldn't get out of his head that Amanda did not pull Adriana from the pool, even though that fact is not in dispute. If that were the case, it's easy to see juror James Locke's conclusion at the end of that clip, that if Amanda didn't try to save her daughter, there was something wrong with her. It turns out, though, that James Locke was wrong. But oddly enough, there was something wrong with James Locke. In 1996, 12 years before Amanda's trial, he was charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, false imprisonment, and battery. In the end, he was only convicted of misdemeanor battery, which is why he could serve on the jury, and we don't know the facts of the case against him. What we do know is that one of Amanda's six jurors was someone charged with a very serious crime and convicted of battery, as well as someone who had read about her case in the news and might have anchored onto the false narrative that it was the police and not Amanda who had pulled Adriana from the pool.
A final issue that popped up during jury selection was that a number of prospective jurors actually worked at the same nursing center in Bonifay as Amanda. As one example, here's juror Jessica Davison.
Ms. Davidson?
My name is Jessica Davison. I work in the Bonifay Nursing Home. I'm single. I do not have prior jury experience, so I've never testified in court. I'm not a victim of crime. I know there ain't a long years and a lot related to one law.
Okay, thank you.
Like Locke, Jessica Davison had also read about the case in the newspaper. Specifically, Davison and the other prospective jurors were initially asked this question by Judge Register.
I would ask that you would raise your hand if you have heard or read any news reports about this case, or if you have heard any talk about this case other than what you heard the attorneys talking about this morning. So if you've heard or read anything other than what you heard in the courtroom this morning, if you would raise your hand at this time.
And then here was what Jessica Davison said when Judge Register followed up with her individually.
Ms. Davidson, where did you get your information? And which newspaper was that? Okay.
Like Locke, Jessica Davison was also selected as a juror, not as one of the presiding jurors, but as the third alternate who would step in if not one, not two, but three jurors dropped out during trial. This then takes us to trial, when the first two dominoes fell. Specifically, at the start of trial, Judge Register asked if any jurors wanted to take notes. In response, only two jurors raised their hands, Jerry Lynn Paul, a correctional officer, and Kimberly Swanson, who worked at a nursery. Both jurors had indicated that they'd heard nothing about the case coming in. We can then fast forward to the start of the second day of Amanda's four-day trial when Paul and Swanson didn't show up. Here's what Amanda had to say about it.
On the second day of trial, two of the six jurors don't show up and they had to be replaced by alternate jurors. Do you remember this happening in the courtroom?
Yes.
And
because
what was
the, it was the only two people that asked to take notes.
Mm-hmm. And so what's going through your head when you hear the only two jurors asking to take notes have now left the jury and been replaced?
I think that was when I kind of started getting the sickening feeling that I'm done for.
Mm-hmm.
Because I felt like that was really the only thing that was going to keep me afloat was these people that were adamant about taking notes to be able to remember every detail. And now you've taken them off.
Right.
And so these two jurors were replaced by the first two alternate jurors, with one of those alternates being a man named Raymond Anderson. But then, on the final day of trial, just before closing arguments, Judge Register did some housekeeping without the jurors in the courtroom. And what he said to a court officer about the lunch order was weird and cryptic.
Tell him we're going to begin about 10:45. Tell them also that you will be bringing in a menu for them to indicate what they would like for us to order them for lunch. Now, there are only these six of them who get lunch. Mr. Anderson, we do not. Now, ask them to put their name on their menu, what they're ordering. And because I don't want Mr. Anderson to know and Ms. Davidson to know about this switch we're making until we make it here in the courtroom. Because I don't want it to become an issue in the jury room as to why Mr. Anderson was switched out. And I think that's what we talked about yesterday. All right, we will be in recess and the attorneys will have until 10:45.
So yeah, this is supremely strange. Here, you hear Judge Register initially saying they should tell juror Raymond Anderson that he's being taken off the jury and replaced by alternate juror Jessica Davison. But then he catches himself and says that every juror should write their name on their lunch order so that juror Anderson, juror Davison, and the other jurors won't know what's going on. And as you heard, his concern was the chaos this would cause if the jury learned he was about to switch jurors. At this point, you might be wondering what the hell was going on, and you wouldn't be alone. As you will hear later, Amanda had no idea what the judge was doing, and nothing was clarified by what happened later in court. If you watched the trial on court TV, you wouldn't see it. The video cuts out right after Judge Register gives jury instructions. But we got Amanda's trial transcript earlier this year. And there, right after those instructions, we have the following exchange between Judge Register and juror Raymond Anderson.
Mr. Anderson, do you have anything in the jury room?
No, sir.
Okay, if you'll just stay with us, Ms. Davison, you are the sixth juror to deliberate.
And that's it. Juror Jessica Davison sat through the 4 days of trial thinking she was an alternate. And then, just before deliberations, without any explanation, she was told that Anderson was out and she was in. She would be the final juror deciding Amanda's fate. I'm not going to lie, most of my holiday gifts, actually gifts all year round, end up in a drawer or the back of my closet or accidentally left at my cousin's house or sometimes accidentally re-gifted, but not this one. Mint Mobile is offering unlimited premium wireless for $15 a month. That is their best deal of the year, aka the only holiday gift I'll actually be using every single day. Mint Mobile's best deal of the year is happening right now. You can get a 3, 6, or 12-month unlimited plan for just $15 a month. All Mint plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text on the nation's largest 3G network. You can bring your current phone and phone number over to Mint. There's no contracts and no nonsense. I want you to think about how much you spend every month on your cell phone plans for you and for other members of your family and the savings you will get by switching to Mint. In times like these, we all need to think smarter and shop better. By switching to Mint, I am saving over $100 a month, and I know we could all use that, especially as the holidays approach. So look, don't get them socks. Don't get yourself socks. Get yourself and your loved one premium wireless for $15 a month. Shop Mint unlimited plans at mintmobile.com/undisclosed. That's mintmobile.com/undisclosed. Limited time offer, upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12 months. Plan required, $15 a month equivalent. Taxes and fees extra. Initial plan term only. Greater than 35 gigabytes may slow down when network is busy. Capable device required. Availability, speed, and coverage varies. See mintmobile.com.
This was a jury that decided quickly. Less than 2 hours into deliberations, including eating lunch, the jury indicated they were back with a verdict. Here's what Amanda told me about all this.
What is going through your head when you hear the jury has returned a verdict very quickly and you're sitting there in the courtroom waiting for that verdict to be read?
I was very nervous, very scared. Because when we were waiting for them to deliberate, we were in the back room, and I remember the statement that my dad made to me in that room, whenever Walter came in and told us the different things that they could come back with. Right. And he said what he felt like they would come back with, which he felt like that they would come back with neglect. That I could have took. But when my daddy looked me square in my face and told me, I have a gut feeling that they're going to come back with the worst that they can come back with. And they did. I think I was in shock again because I really didn't know what was going on.
Right.
After being convicted of murder and given a sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole, Amanda has spent the last 17 years behind bars. And during this time, like so many of the people whose cases we've covered, what started out as anger and aimlessness for Amanda eventually turned to passion and purpose, including recently enrolling in a paralegal program.
In our previous discussions, my understanding is that you're a bit of a jailhouse lawyer, that you're helping out a lot of other inmates with their cases. And so can you tell me a bit about your work in helping other inmates with their cases while incarcerated?
Yes. There's a few people that I help them do their application. And some I am assisting them with research, file motions, stuff that we can do from in here, until when and if their application might be picked up like mine was.
And so what is it that spurred you to take on this role and do this paralegal program and help other inmates out with their cases?
I think it's because of being on this side, mm-hmm. I see what this feels like. And the more that I see other people are going through what I am, literally, it gives me purpose and it gives me pride in myself to be able to give back what was given to me.
Aside from that work you're doing in prison, as you say, it gives you hope. What has life in prison been like for you?
In the beginning, it was a struggle. It was very, very hard. I was very angry, very bitter. I don't know if she would remember it, but my nanny had a conversation with me on the phone where, and at visitation. And as a matter of fact, it was the first visit. My dad and my stepmom brought her. And I had, unfortunately, went to confinement. So I had to see her through a window instead of, you know, out in the open. Mm-hmm. And she begged me to please let go of some of the anger that I had, because who she was looking at was not her granddaughter. That I had changed into somebody she didn't know. My life when I first got here was, I was, like I said, very angry, very physical. I took my anger out, you know, physically, stayed in confinement. Awful. I was awful, awful. And it took that last visit where she begged me crying. And I hate seeing people, period, cry. But when it's my nanny, it broke my heart. And that was when I tried to find my reasoning, try to find some type of peace somewhere. And it was in the law library. I started working on my own case, seeing what the other girls were doing. I started mimicking, listening. So in the end, I got a job in the law library first as being the typist. Mm-hmm. And there was one law clerk in particular that took me under her wing. And she taught me so much that I now use to help other people.
Now, here you heard Amanda speaking to the anger and rage that consumed her when she first went to prison. It's important to note that none of that anger has ever been directed at her son, AJ. Here was what she told Piers Morgan for Killer Women.
What do you feel about AJ? He's now 15. You've not seen him for 7-8 years since he was in that courtroom testifying against you.
Mm-hmm.
If you had the chance to speak to him, what would you say to him?
That I love him. And no matter what, I will always love him. And that in no way do I blame him for what's happened.
This takes us to AJ today. We've mentioned before that Amanda lived in Esto, in the panhandle of Florida. The northern border of Esto is actually southern Alabama, and that's where all of Amanda's family, including her mom Brenda, lived. And so, with Amanda being sent to prison, there was a lot of family law drama, given that AJ was in Florida, but all of his family was in Alabama. As a result, unbeknownst to Amanda at first, AJ was adopted into another family because none of his family lived in Florida. Here was Amanda learning this for the first time on 2020.
As for AJ, Amanda says what sustains her is the hope of one day reuniting with her only child that she has left. But it's a day more doubtful than even she knows.
The circumstances are, if I win my case and I'm released, then I get my son back.
Hasn't he been adopted?
Not to my knowledge.
AJ's been adopted. You didn't know that?
No. I've been fighting all this time to get out of here, to get to him. And now, what am I fighting for?
Amanda lost that appeal she mentioned. In fact, she's exhausted all of her appeals. And so, as of a couple of years ago, it looked like she'd remain behind bars forever. But then, she got a lifeline.
the Georgetown Making an Exoneree program decided to take up her case.
Yeah, what's your reaction when you first hear that Amanda and Georgetown University, such a respected school, is taking up your case and is going to fight for your cause?
I'll never forget that phone call because I put my whole dorm on panic mode. Because when she told me, I screamed. I'm like, you have got to be kidding. And everybody automatically thinks something's wrong. So people are getting up out of their beds, coming to make sure, you know, and, you know, it was awesome. It was an awesome feeling.
That program has students investigating possible wrongful convictions and producing short documentaries on their cases. It's run by Mark Howard and Marty Tencliffe, himself an exoneree. But the person responsible for Amanda's case is actually Dr. Amanda Lewis. Yes, that's right. This is a case with two Amanda Lewises, and they're both from Florida. Dr. Amanda Lewis received her PhD from the University of Florida in criminology, sociology, and the law. She's part of Georgetown's Prisons and Justice Initiative, where she actually did her orientation alongside Adnan Syed. As the Georgetown students were putting together the documentary about Amanda's case, Dr. Amanda reached out to AJ, who now has a new name. She wanted to see if he was okay with what the students were doing, which he was. With Dr. Amanda's permission, here's what AJ told her when she spoke to him. First, AJ indicated he was interested in updates about what Dr. Amanda and the students had found. Second, AJ did not have a memory of speaking with Chuck Burns, his grandmother's boyfriend, about what had happened. Recall that AJ didn't tell the police at the trailer in the aftermath of the drowning that his mom had drowned his sister, but according to Chuck, he spontaneously made this claim while he was driving to his home. Third, from both AJ's own memory and watching coverage of the case, he's aware that there were serious issues with how he was interrogated and being asked leading questions without someone with training in how to interview a child. Fourth, AJ was not aware of the issues with medical examiner Dr. Charles Siebert and was curious about them. And fifth and finally, AJ does stand behind what he testified to at trial. With AJ's blessing, the Georgetown students produced the documentary on Amanda's case, and I virtually attended the gala where they presented it. Based on what seemed like a serious miscarriage of justice, I reached out to Dr. Amanda and agreed to look at Amanda's case with a disclaimer that I didn't know if I would find any appealable issues. But after reviewing all the files and speaking with inmate Amanda, I agreed to take on the case, thinking this was clearly a wrongful conviction. Shortly thereafter, we were contacted by a reporter named Greg Woodfield at the Daily Mail. He said he wanted to cover the case and that it would be a fair look at the case and not a hit job against Amanda. He also indicated the angle he wanted to take was talking to AJ, which no one else had done. I and the rest of Team Amanda got a bad vibe from Greg and thought he did want to do a hit piece. Nonetheless, we talked to inmate Amanda, and it was an absolute no on her end. She didn't want to talk to Greg, and she definitely didn't want to reach out to AJ. That's consistent with my own conversation with Amanda. When talking about undisclosed coverage of the case, she said the one thing she didn't want me to do was to invade AJ's privacy and talk to him for our podcast. She didn't want anything to disturb his peace, even if it could help her be freed. We conveyed these concerns to Greg, telling them that Amanda definitely did not want him to reach out to AJ.
Nonetheless, Greg did reach out to AJ, and he published his Daily Mail story about it in April of this year. And simply put, it was a hit piece. We are at that time of year that we are just losing daylight day by day, and it just feels like there's not enough time, not enough hours in the day to get done everything you need to. And for me, the one thing that often falls off my to-do list and just I can not get to lately is making a home-cooked meal for my family. There's that, and there's also the fact that, I mean, like, I'm sure so many other parents out there, you just run out of ideas. Like, my rotation, you know, is exhausted at this point. But that's why I love Factor. They have chef-prepared, dietitian-approved meals that make it easy to stay on track, to give your family comforting, delicious meals that taste home cooked, no matter how hectic the season gets. And they have such an incredible variety that, well, you will never get exhausted from their rotation. Factor has a wider than ever selection of weekly meal options, including premium seafood choices like salmon and shrimp at no extra cost. This week, my Factor meals were all high protein meals because I want the high protein meals to support my wellness goals. But they also have GLP-1 friendly meals and new Mediterranean diet options that are packed with protein and good for you fats. And for the first time, they've got Asian-inspired meals with bold flavors influenced by China, Thailand, and more. For more choices to better nutrition, it's why 97% of customers say that Factor helped them live a healthier life. You can feel the difference no matter your routine. Thank you, Factor, for saving my life this week a couple of times because dinner was on Factor. So eat smart at factormeals.com/towardjustice50off. That's 50, the number, off, and use code towardjustice50off to get 50% off your first box. Plus, you get free breakfast for a whole year. That's code towardjustice50off at factormeals.com for 50% off your first box and free breakfast for an entire year. You get delicious, ready-to-eat meals delivered with Factor. Offer only valid for new Factor customers with code and qualifying auto-renewing subscription purchase. In it, Greg quotes AJ as saying that Amanda is, quote, 100% guilty and that, quote, I stand by every word I said. Now, you'll note that this is not necessarily different from what AJ told Dr. Amanda, because recall, AJ told Dr. Amanda that he stands behind what he testified to at trial. But the Daily Mail doesn't mention that AJ can't remember his talk with Chuck Burns or that AJ acknowledges police interrogation was handled poorly with leading and suggestive questions. And as you might recall from child competency expert Dr. J. Zoe Klemfuss, either of these events could have caused permanent damage to AJ's memory.
Because that first interview is so important, mm-hmm. Right? So it's where you're potentially getting the child's most fresh and authentic reaction to the event. But it's also a really, really risky time for setting the child's memory off course. Mm-hmm. So if the questioning in that context is poor and not being monitored, not being administered by someone who has really high quality training on how to do it, it can be permanently damaging to the child's statement.
Got it.
In other words, if Chuck Burns or the police officers consciously or unconsciously manipulated AJ into misremembering his mom drowning his sister, that could have become his permanent memory, rather than what he observed. And, of course, it bears repeating that AJ told Sarah Campbell of the Child Protection Team that same night that he did not see his sister getting dunked.
And what was his response to that question?
AJ denied seeing her get dunked.
Okay.
Now, there's another part of the Daily Mail story, and it's one we take seriously when reviewing cases. And that's this. When asked about life with Amanda before Adriana drowned, AJ mentions being abused. Again, this is a sensitive subject, and it's one we brought up briefly in the prior episode through the testimony by Adriana's teacher in the school year that ended mere months before the drowning.
Now, as a teacher, are you all educated or schooled to look for signs of abuse?
Yes, we are.
Your children, and did you ever detect any signs of abuse?
I never saw any bruises. She seemed very happy, and we talked every day. Graceville Elementary is a very small school, and I don't have a big class. I had a very small class, so we were very close. All my students and myself were very close. And she loved her brother. She talked about her mother in high regard.
Okay. And you never had any concerns about her being abused or not being taken care of? Or...
No, I did not.
Okay. Thank you.
But a teacher not seeing signs of abuse doesn't prove the absence of abuse. So was there abuse of Adriana? And if so, what was it? You'll recall that Alan Jr., the 14-year-old son of Amanda's boyfriend, lived part-time at the trailer. And here is what he told the police.
She ever been mean? I mean, mistreated you in any way? Have you ever seen her mistreat them other two in any way? Ever seen her whip them?
have her with him.
Which one?
Otto.
A lot?
A lot.
You ever seen any bruising on them or anything like that?
No, sir.
You know what she was whipping them with?
A bill, I guess.
Shut us out, though.
In case you couldn't hear all that, Alan Jr. said that Amanda never mistreated him, Adriana, or AJ. But he added that, while it wasn't often, there were a few times when it sounded like Amanda was doing what's known as belting in Florida, spanking the kids on the butt with a belt as a form of corporal punishment. AJ never testified to this at trial, but he did reference it in his police statement. This is the only time in the record that AJ mentioned physical punishment. Here's what he said his mom did while she was drowning his sister.
Mama was... she was pointing to my toys that I was playing with, my tractors.
Why?
Because I was going to get in trouble.
For what?
I'll get whipping in a then. I'll have to get grounded like my sister.
On the one hand, this takes us back to the unreliability of AJ's narrative. AJ has consistently said that he was playing with the tractors in front of the trailer, which is where they were when the police arrived. But here, he says that his mom saw him playing with his tractors while she was drowning his sister in the pool that was in the backyard. On the other hand, AJ does mention how if he misbehaved, he could be whipped, which seems like a reference to the occasional beltings that Alan Jr. mentioned in his police statement. This would explain the abuse AJ describes in the Daily Mail article, while also explaining why Adriana's teacher didn't know about it, because it was done on her butt. The concept of corporal punishment through spanking a child with a wooden paddle or belt is controversial, especially in Florida. And that's not just in households, but also in classrooms. In 2021, this issue came to a head when a school principal delivered 3 hard hits with a paddle to a 6-year-old who had misbehaved. Here's reporting by Tampa Bay 28.
Welcome back. Well, listen to this. New at 4, Florida school principal now under investigation for hitting a 6-year-old with a paddle. Her mother watching and recording the whole thing. You may find the video difficult. This is Principal Melissa Carter in Clewiston hitting the little girl with a wooden paddle 3 times because she allegedly scratched a school computer.
With the case getting a lot of media attention, but many legislators still thinking that paddling is proper punishment, Florida reps ended up reaching a compromise approach just a couple of months ago. Under this approach, parents can opt in or opt out of corporal punishment. If they want their kid paddled or belted by their teacher for misbehaving, they can opt in. And if they don't, they can opt out.
The ultimate goal, according to critics of this practice, is for Florida to eventually join the 33 other states that have banned corporal punishment altogether. But State Representative Dana Trabolsi says lawmakers weren't ready to go that far this year.
And so this is kind of a compromise of keeping it and then, like, still allowing it for those that want to keep it.
Correct.
Needless to say, the idea of belting or paddling a child for misbehaving is something that makes a lot of people uneasy, and one of them is Amanda herself. Colin broached the subject with her, asking how she was disciplined when she herself misbehaved as a child.
And in terms of, as you say, some misbehaving, what type of discipline and punishment did you grow up with when you did misbehave and needed discipline?
With my daddy, the majority of the time, it was a whooping, the old-fashioned way. My mom, most of the time with her, it was like being grounded, taking privileges. She wasn't one for, you know, physical punishment.
Right.
My dad, on the other hand, that was a different story. He would rather just whip you, get it over with, and let's move on.
Got it.
This then ties into what Amanda told the authorities on the day of the drowning. There's no audio recording of Amanda's second police interview on the day of the drowning, but we do have the transcript, and here's a pertinent portion where the topic of punishment comes up.
Have you ever dunked her in any water?
No, because she panics so much, and no, I don't dunk her in water.
How about AJ? You ever do that when you're playing with him?
Not dunking him under the water. We'll throw him up and let him go in the water, but I've never dunked him in the water.
Was he scared of that?
Who?
AJ?
Oh, he loves it, but I did that one time to her, and she panicked, and I've not done it no more.
Well, why would AJ indicate that you had mistreated him at all? Can you give me any ideas?
I don't know why he would say that I've mistreated him. I mean, I can't even stand to whip them. That's why most of the time I make them go to his room, because that's all my daddy did to me was whip me. And so if you believe Amanda, her dad did beltings of her butt when she was a child. She didn't like this form of discipline, but did it infrequently with AJ and Adriana, even though she didn't like doing it. This would be consistent with what Alan Jr. and AJ told the police and the testimony by Adriana's teacher that she didn't see any signs of abuse. Now, we have no way of knowing whether Amanda is telling the truth, but the one thing we can say is that she's been totally consistent about everything over the years. In telling her story of the day of the drowning dozens of times over the years, she has said the same thing over and over again. And what she says lines up with all the evidence that we have in the record. Nonetheless, when we took up her case, she was out of appellate options, and it looked like she'd remain behind bars forever.
But, as I noted earlier, we got Amanda's trial transcripts earlier this year. I read the testimony from day one, then day two. When I got to day three, there were the following headings at the start of the transcript before the testimony for the day. In conference room with judge and attorneys. Defendant not present. Juror Anderson enters conference room. It was written like a movie script, setting the scene. A scene not captured in the recording of the trial. A scene that should soon lead to Amanda being set free. Because here's what happened. The bailiff brought juror Raymond Anderson to the conference room. You might recall that he was one of the alternate jurors who was turned into a presiding juror when the two note-taking jurors did not show up on day two. That then left six presiding jurors, and Jessica Davison's the only remaining alternate. Meaning that if two more jurors dropped out, a mistrial would have to be declared. When Juror Anderson entered, Judge Register asked him what was up. Juror Anderson responded that when he went home after day two of trial, his wife told him that their daughter-in-law was a cousin of Amanda's boyfriend, Alan Carnley. When asked what degree, i.e. first or second degree cousin, Anderson didn't know. When Juror Anderson was asked whether this would impact his ability to be fair and impartial, he answered, no, sir. When Juror Anderson was then asked whether he thought this could put him in an uncomfortable spot with his wife and his in-laws, he then responded, quote, well, it just being my daughter-in-law, it's something, you know, that come up, that would be the onlyest thing. Judge Register then told Juror Anderson to leave the conference room. This then led to one of the craziest things I've ever seen. Judge Register decided this was dicey, but not dicey enough to remove Juror Anderson from the jury. Instead, he decided on the following. He would shift Juror Anderson to an alternate juror, and he would make alternate juror Jessica Davison a presiding juror. But he wouldn't tell the jurors, including Jessica Davison, that he was doing this swap until the very end of trial, which is what you heard happen before in the audio of the trial. And indeed, Judge Register sold the story that Juror Anderson remained a presiding juror for the rest of the trial, by having him still sit in his same chair in the front row of the jury box rather than shifting him to the back row. The reason for this subterfuge was that Judge Register was worried about two jurors already failing to show up, with his fear being that any more oddities would lead to another juror dropping out. This was the same fear you heard in the clip regarding the jurors' lunch orders. And to hedge his bets, Judge Register did not deem Raymond Anderson disqualified to serve as a juror. Instead, he explicitly said that if one of the other six jurors didn't show up or was dismissed, Raymond Anderson would be shifted back to be a presiding juror, one of the six deciding Amanda's case. In addition to being extremely messed up, this was a critical error by Judge Register. And not just a critical error, but a fundamental error, meaning the defendant can raise it at any time, even after she's exhausted her appeals, because it goes to the heart of the right to trial by jury. You see, once a jury is impaneled, a judge can only remove a presiding juror if he finds that he's unqualified to serve. Here, the exact opposite happened. Judge Register explicitly found that Raymond Anderson was qualified as a juror, and indeed, that he could serve as one if one of the other jurors had to drop out before the end of trial. I don't think Judge Register could have disqualified Raymond Anderson based upon his daughter-in-law being a cousin of Alan Carnley, but my opinion doesn't matter. Judge Register found it was not disqualifying, so he had no grounds to remove him from his status as a presiding juror. And then, there was a second fundamental error, allowing Amanda to appeal even today. And that's this. As we noted, Amanda was not present for this conference with juror Raymond Anderson. The problem here is the defendant has the right to be present for every critical stage of a trial, including decisions regarding removal of presiding jurors. And as noted, Amanda was not present for this conference. Now, in fairness, Florida law says the defendant's absence can be cured if the reasons for the removal are later cleared with the defendant. But here, they weren't. I spoke with Amanda's trial attorney, and he's confirmed and written an affidavit indicating that he never told Amanda what had happened during this conference. And here's what Amanda had to say when I discussed the issue with her.
Take me back to the jury. What's your reaction when you hear, just a few months ago, that on this third day of trial in the morning, this juror, who had some connection to Alan, if anything, is probably favorable to you as a juror, that the judge had made this switch and kept it a secret from both the jurors and you for the rest of trial before making this change at the end of trial?
I'm not going to speak freely because I'll probably have to repent for what I want to say, but it was very, I got very angry.
Mm-hmm.
Because I felt like nothing was done fair. Everything was stacked against me. I had no chance at all. And the few chances that I would have had, they completely took them away by taking the two jurors and then now finding out they switched one that could have possibly, you know, put a monkey wrench in what they were trying to do.
Right.
So that's two clear fundamental errors that should lead to Amanda's murder conviction being reversed. One, Judge Register removing a juror despite finding him qualified to serve. And two, doing this without Amanda being present and without her assent. But then, there's a third clear error, and this takes us back to the start of this episode. Having learned what happened with Jessica Davis and being subbed in, she seemed like the most critical juror to contact. But before we get to that, I was doing due diligence on Jessica's age at the time of trial. And what I found was that, as far as we can tell, she was born in June 1990. I must have looked at that date at least a dozen times, because you might recall that Amanda's murder trial was in February 2008. And so, if we have the date right, Jessica was only 17 years old at the time of trial. Like every other state in the country, Florida says that someone must be 18 years old to serve in a jury, with some states having a higher minimum age. I checked this date with Team Amanda, and the consensus seems to be that yes, juror Jessica was only 17 at the time of trial. Here was what Amanda had to say when we discussed my discovery.
And so one thing you learned recently, if our records are correct, which I think they are, is that you have to be at least 18 years old to be a juror in Florida. And our research tends to show Jessica Davis in this final juror was only 17 years old. What's your reaction to learning that?
Wow. It's just something else to add to the injustice. Because in my mind, I'm thinking, well, if they did this to me, they probably did it to other people too.
Right.
Now, like me, you might have thought this was a slam dunk issue. If one of the six jurors was 17 years old and unqualified to serve, that should be automatic grounds for reversing Amanda's murder conviction. But it turns out that Florida law also requires the defendant to prove prejudice. In other words, she has to prove that one of her jurors being underage contributed to her conviction. Well, that takes us to a fourth appealable issue. This one both supports the prior issue and stands on its own. You see, to get further insight into Jessica Davidson's thought process, I asked Dr. Amanda to reach out to her. And so, this led to one Amanda Lewis asking this last-second replacement juror about her vote to find the other Amanda Lewis guilty of felony murder. Their talk soon turned to the lead agent on the case, Michael Raley.
Something didn't fit right with the way that the situation was with him investigating the whole ordeal.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Was it things that he said, like, while he was testifying, or things he said, like, just in court, like, not under oath and things like that?
Both.
Okay. You remember anything specific about what he said, or just, Like, it doesn't have to be like an exact quote, but just like general statements or the way you kind of spoke about it.
Just like he, like, she shouldn't have had kids, that, and just like, so that she was a drug addict, and just all kinds of other things that were said that wasn't even on topic of the case.
And he was saying that.
Yes. And it wasn't, and that wasn't in the court. That was just out and about around people that knew about the case and where he talked about it.
Wow. Yeah, nothing that we know about a man at the time, you know, would indicate the back is anything that he was saying there is accurate, right? Like, he definitely wasn't a drug user or anything like that. Wow. So these were things that he was saying during, like, the trial period of time?
Yeah, like around the time when it was all going on.
Wow. Insane. I'm trying to think of other, like, our questions. This is just wild to me. Was there anybody that you knew, like, in town that he was, who kind of, like, you'd have been around him or would have been around people that would have heard it a lot? Or was it just kind of things that got back to you or you, you know, encountered him?
I encountered one day, I was there in, it used to be IGA. Now it was Doc's Market. Now it's the Mercer Outlet, but it was IGA. And he was in the IGA, and he was talking to another fellow deputy. The deputy was in uniform, and he wasn't.
Okay.
And he was talking about it. And I didn't know who he was at the time until after I met him during the trial, or with all that.
Wow. So you were hearing him talking about it in town before the trial even happened, while they were probably investigating or whatnot.
Yeah. Damn.
Just to make all that clear, before trial, juror Jessica Davison was shopping at the supermarket. And while she was there, she overheard Michael Raley telling a uniformed deputy that Amanda Lewis should never have had kids because she was a drug addict. To refresh your recollection, Michael Raley was the lead police officer on Amanda's case, the one who took photos of the pool and the wagon on the day of the drowning, one of the two officers who interrogated AJ also on the day of the drowning, the one who wrote the investigative report with the false claim that first responder Charles Corcoran claimed in his reenactment that his CPR would not have caused trauma to Adriana's head, the one who made the decision to get an arrest warrant for Amanda, and the one who testified against Amanda at trial. Indeed, Michael Raley took the witness stand three separate times at trial, and he testified for longer than any other witness. And so here we have a 70-year-old juror overhearing Michael Raley saying before trial that Amanda was a drug addict who never should have had children. Imagine the kind of impact hearing that would have on any juror, let alone one who was 17. Now, notably, as Dr. Amanda said, there's no evidence in the record that inmate Amanda ever used, let alone abused, drugs. Indeed, all indications are that she barely even drank alcohol. Here was a pertinent portion of her police statement when she was being questioned about the wagon that was pulled next to the pool by, you guessed it, Michael Raley.
And the wagon was over there.
Close to the dirt road.
Because AJ put dirt in it.
Okay. What about the old beer bottles in there? It was broke. Anything about that?
AJ brought them out of the woods. He'd go across the street with that little dirt hill and bring all kind of stuff out of the woods.
Okay.
But neither one of us drink, so it's not ours.
Yeah, it looked pretty old.
And people throw them outside the road right there at our house.
And this is where the theme for this whole season comes together. Mothers being wrongfully convicted because they are framed as bad mothers. Here, even before trial, one of the six jurors deciding Amanda's fate heard from the lead officer in the case that Amanda was a bad mom who should never have kids because she was a drug addict. It was a complete lie, and it should have disqualified Davison from being a juror, but she didn't report it. As we noted earlier in the episode, Jessica Davison did raise her hand when asked whether she had read or heard anything about the case, but when she was asked individually, she simply said she'd read about it in the newspaper. She never mentioned overhearing this conversation, a conversation that surely would have led defense counsel striking her for cause. Any juror failing to report this would be fundamental error and grounds for a new trial. But beyond that, this is where the prejudice of an underage juror comes into play. Someone older and wiser might be more likely to recognize that this should be reported, but Jessica Davison did not. Here's what Amanda said when Colin spoke to her about this topic.
Before trial, I was at the supermarket. I see Michael Raley speaking with a uniformed officer, and I hear Michael Raley saying, "You never should have had children because you're a bad mother and a drug addict."
Wow.
How does it feel when you learn about that?
I have never done drugs a day in my life.
And my understanding is you didn't drink alcohol either. Is that correct?
I mean, on occasion, like at family, you know, functions or something, but no, it wasn't something that I did all the time, no.
Right. And so how does it feel to hear that the lead agent on your case is A, making up a total lie, and B, is overheard by this 17-year-old juror who's deciding your fate?
Once again, very aggravating. Because it's like you're compiling one lie on top of another to try to make a truth. Mm-hmm. And you can't, but ultimately your lies outweighed my truth because I'm sitting here.
But now there's new hope for Amanda with the four appealable issues we have just mentioned. But just as Amanda has her highest hope for freedom in 17 years, she's also had to come face to face with her own mortality based on issues that our prison system is not equipped to address.
In terms of feeling, I don't know whether you're comfortable sharing this or not, but in terms of your current health, what are you currently facing there in prison?
Well, first, I thought I was having problems with my heart, but it's ultimately turned out just my anxiety. I've been having anxiety attacks. But the worst is I might be facing possibly having breast cancer. They're ordering more tests, and then we're going to go from there. I've been down this road before. Mammograms, sonograms, biopsies, I've did it before. So I know what I'm prepared for, but knowing that this might possibly be it's a little upsetting.
Right. Luckily, while you've been covering Amanda's case, she's been thrown a lifeline. A few years ago, a Florida man named Thomas Raynard James was exonerated after 32 years of wrongful conviction. The attorney who helped set him free was Natalie Figgers, a recent law school graduate who logged over 2,000 hours in this case.
According to James and his lawyer, Natalie Figgers, the facts are this is a case of mistaken identity.
I'm 1,000% sure that my client is innocent.
Natalie Figgers eventually convinced the local conviction integrity unit that James was innocent and the victim of a wrongful conviction. With her passion to right wrongs, she reached out about handling Amanda's appeal. Here was Amanda's reaction to first meeting her. At the same time, you have attorney Figgers agreeing to take on your case pro bono and coming to meet you. And what is your reaction? How do you feel when attorney Figgers agrees to take your case and comes in and meets with you?
Oh, she is awesome. She's awesome. I think my description of her, by the way she talked and her confidence and just her, how do I say it? Her security and her abilities.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I find it I love to see a confident woman because women, to me, aren't afforded the same privileges sometimes as men or looked at the same times as men. So to see her being so confident, it's another attraction because it's a beautiful thing to me. But I think my description of her would probably be more along the lines of maybe a pit bull in a chihuahua body, because she's so tiny.
Yeah.
But she has that fierceness that I think that would probably be my description of her.
I've been working with Attorney Figures and the rest of Team Amanda on Amanda's appeal for a long time, making sure we dotted all our I's and crossed all our T's. By the time this episode airs, it's likely we already filed her appeal, perhaps setting the wheels in motion for her final freedom. And so, to close this season, we'll end with two final questions I asked Amanda.
I just have two final questions. The first is, and I just need to get this on the record because you know I believe you. I just want to get this audio for the podcast, but did you dunk Adriana in the pool?
Absolutely not.
And then last question before I see if you have anything else to add is, if this all does work out and you are freed all these years later, what do you plan and hope to do if and when you're released?
Breathe, for one. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure I finish with my paralegal, and I want to go to work somewhere that will continue with my passion, which is helping women that's been through the same situation as me. Mm-hmm. Because the men seem to have more going for them than what women do. It's harder for women to get their voice heard than it is men. And I want to be that outside voice.
This closes up our official season on the Amanda Lewis case, but we'll be back the next couple of weeks with follow-up episodes. Then we'll transition into weekly episodes where Colin and I will talk about other things related to true crime based on our cases, to one-off episodes on wrongful convictions and other cases in the news that we want to talk about. And then, next year, like Amanda's case, we will be keeping our focus on wrongfully convicted women. The next season of Undisclosed will be coming next spring and focus on a woman who was wrongfully convicted of not one, but two murders. Next time on Undisclosed.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners, it's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. As you know, we did something new a few months ago by utilizing SpeakPipe as a way for you guys to leave us voice notes. For anyone new here, you can go to speakpipe.com/undisclosed to leave us your questions or thoughts and comments. Since the response to SpeakPipe has been so amazing, we've got two additional exciting announcements to make. First, we have a new Facebook community group where you can engage with us and one another about all things true crime and criminal justice. Just go to facebook.com/groups/toward justice and answer three simple questions and you're in. In addition to that, we also just relaunched our Patreon page at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. So many folks have already signed up and we can't express our gratitude enough to each and every single one of you. Even a dollar goes a long way and allows us to do the work pro bono for our defendants. Also, I would like to give a quick shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production, as well as Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music. To engage with us on social media, we're on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. You can find us on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're new or a returning listener, you can check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our revamped website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can follow Rabia at RabiaSquared2, the number 2, on Instagram, and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for your continued support for us and for supporting our sponsors. Until next time.